How does the boring census in the opening chapters of Numbers, a mysterious life-giving river in Ezekiel 47, and the lost sheep, coin, and son parables by Yeshua, or Jesus, in Luke 15, all tell one unified story? Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. The following study reveals how God counts every name, pursues every lost one, and turns spiritual deserts into places of living water. We'll weave together Torah, prophets, and gospel to confront lone wolf faith, expose our ideas of holiness, and reveal why heaven refuses to settle for acceptable losses in the family of God.
So we can see across all of these passages we're taking a look at here today, because that vision that we get there in Ezekiel 47, it's part of something that we've looked at and referenced a lot, that it's a part of this great third temple revelation that you see in Ezekiel. It spans from Ezekiel 40 through the end of the book in 48. And you'll see echoes of it, quite a few echoes of that in the book of Revelation, quite a lot of them. And I'm sure as we were going through chapter 47, you were probably picking up on a number of those the parallels between Revelation and Ezekiel, and some of which we've talked about before. Daniel's talked a lot about the parallels of measuring the temple there in Ezekiel and measuring the temple in the city in the book of Revelation. So a lot of these things are, yes, happens quite a lot in the Bible, not by coincidence. So what we see is some big ideas from these passages we looked at today is that Adonai does not redeem isolated consumers. So it's not like you're a spiritual consumer and you just kind of go down the buffet of the things in the Bible and I like a big helping of this and a big helping of that. And no, I don't want to eat my spiritual asparagus or my spiritual broccoli or the spiritual kale even. Now I want a big, big helping of the spiritual ice cream. Yes. And the spiritual big the pile of donuts, and I want some of that. Yet what we see throughout the Bible is that he's gathering us around his presence, And as a part of that, he gives each member a place and responsibility, each member has a place and responsibility around his presence. And he then fills all of the people of God with his spirit so that his life can flow outward into a dying world. So, one question we should always ask ourselves, and again here today, are we merely trying to stay spiritually alive ourselves, or are we allowing Adonai's life to flow through us to others around us? All right, so diving in here a bit. Yes, we use a lot of talk here today about these two things. Collectivism, which you can sum up in one way by saying, you know, the group matters, so losing one person is acceptable. You know, it's all about the collective whole, and the one doesn't really matter. Or individualism, you know, my relationship with God is personal, so I do not need a group. So I've got my own connection with God, so don't need other people around. However, what we saw there in the beginning of Numbers is you see a tally of each person into a family, a tribe, and a camp. And it's summarized there in Numbers 1, verse 2, where it says, according to the number, their names, each male, head by head. And one of the things that you'll see in some of these census tallies is, wow, this gets repetitive. And it says the same thing for each particular tribe. And you might notice something if you've ever looked into legal documents, which is a horrifically laborious task. But you will see a whole lot of what we see in Numbers throughout legal documents, and they will get wordy. And I was, well, kind of laugh to my colleagues saying, yeah, if you send a journalist editor into a legal document, it'll be like about 1/20th the size of it, because we'll just edit out all of that duplicative language that's in there, all the repetition that's in there. But the reason why, and a lot of people will quibble about this back and forth about why all that repetition is in there, is basically so any person who's zooming through and skimming through the document and they land on one particular place will get, in a lot of the context around it, what the context and all of the parameters are as much as possible with one particular reading of it. So this message, you could see if there was any chance that someone there in the populace was tuning out until they get to their name. And there's my name. And then they finally start paying attention. Well, then you start losing the context of it. And so thus the repetition, according to the number of names, every male head by head. So thus you've had this ancient discussion, why is the census using terms, and we'll get to them in just a little bit. There's two kind of Hebrew terms that are noted here for taking a census, one of which is to nisa, or to lift the head. And the other one is pakad, which is either to put in order or to make an accounting of something, or to appoint or designate something. So one of the things that we then see in our passage in Luke 15, pursuing one lost member brings them back to the community. And that is what the goal is of this. All right. So one of the things you see throughout scripture is that there is a right time to go with the flow, and there is a wrong time to go with the flow. But one of the right times to go with the flow, and that flow in the general sense and in context of what we talked about with the flowing out of the living water from the temple we saw there in Ezekiel 47, we see a similar sort of thing happening in Genesis 1 and 2. And we see that water separating water from water, and then you had the Spirit of God hovering above the waters, and then you see the waters flowing out from the garden that God had planted, Gan Eden, or the Garden of Eden. So he planted the garden, that there was waters that came out, and they broke into four paths and then flowed out, and you get this picture that water coming from the garden is flowing out into the four directions of the world that are being, in a sense, there. So, and then when you get down into Exodus and Numbers, when it starts talking about the tabernacle, you are seeing that this desire, and we've talked about this a lot when we were going through the book of Vayikra or Leviticus, that the pattern, the layout, and the blueprints for the tabernacle is that they were to be located in the middle of the people. Wherever the people would be and where they would camp, you would have the presence of God, and the tabernacle was smack dab right in the middle of it. And when we get down into Ezekiel, we'll see throughout the particular book, and the passage we're looking at there is near the end, but throughout the entire book, one of the lessons that's being given, again, Ezekiel is bridging right before the exiles and destruction, and then after the exile. So it's kind of bridging both of those. And one of the great messages that comes through the prophet on that is that the presence of God will return, that it won't be always Ichabod or Ichavod, that the glory has departed and has departed and will never return. One of the great scenes that you see throughout the book of Ezekiel is that indeed the glory would return. But basically, you could also say when daddy comes home, he's going to take off his belt. And that's also another lesson that you see throughout the book of Ezekiel. And one of the things that you see is that the book ends, yes, this life is going to flow out from this sanctuary into deadly water and to clean it up in the process. And so in Luke 15, you also see that the scattered people who are scattered as individuals are sought after. Heaven seeks after them, and the people of God seek after them, and they are brought home. They're brought back home. And so you see the God's Spirit dwells with his people as his temple. And the temple made flesh that you see in the beginning of the Gospel of John. So then it ends in Revelation at the end of the book with the river and the tree of life, again, just like what we saw in Ezekiel 47, and that fills the final city, and then the nations receive healing. You see it both in Ezekiel 47 and at the end of Revelation, that the tree, its leaves, will bring the healing of the nations. So this now, so to speak, is meant to bear witness to the not yet and the now of restoration of a temple, physical temple in a physical place after a physical exile of real people is also pointing forward to something that will come and the ultimate restoration of all things. Deborah has a comment or a question over here.
That's funny. I learned this week it's not funny, but there's no such thing as a coincidence. But in the book of Daniel, in many of my Bibles, a lot of them, it said in the book of Daniel, I think, I'm not sure if it's 8 or 11, I was looking, that the people will be, when the people of God are shattered, they said there was a mistranslation called shattered instead of the people of God being shattered. So when their spelling errors are like that, I've noticed a lot of them in the newer versions of the Bibles, and not so much the King James Version, but it can really oppress you and give you the wrong impression of what it is God is doing. Because one little word, I've noticed several of them in the Bible now, in the last few weeks since I've been laying at home, that there is a lot of errors, but just words that are so close, but mean so differently. One is oppressive, and one is hope. So I've noticed, you know, and so you said scattered because it was in the book of Daniel, it says when the people of God are shattered.
That's a longer discussion, but in some of those, you can have words that mean shattered and scattered also together. So there are words with the shades of meaning. You'll see one of the books that I often recommend is the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. So you can see when you're going through in certain words, the whole shades of meaning that show up throughout the word. And thus, when you're wondering, well, why does this translation pick this word for it and this translation pick that word for it? And you might see that shattered and scattered, depending on how they're used throughout the Bible, can be very similar on how the word is used. So that's why, you know, if you are wondering between translations, why did a translator pick this one versus another? Looking under the hood with the help of a handy tool and a very accessible tool is the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. So there are some online Bible packages that do include that as well, and you can get a hard copy. I know John's had access to that hard copy as well, so you can easily find that. It's a really helpful tool to look under the hood a bit and see some shades of meaning on it. Yeah, concordance, like the Strong's Concordance, the one thing that the danger, and you'll hear a lot of people who deal with the languages will say, it is a challenge because since it doesn't provide the context of why these different meanings are there, it almost becomes like, I like that meaning and I pick that one. So that's where the one that has a little bit of explanation for how they are used can be helpful to sort out between the shades of meaning. And the Theological Word Book is a great one because usually what it will say is, okay, this verb here in Hebrew, because of how it's used, it kind of encapsulates this kind of a picture of thought. And then we can start seeing where the different applications of it in various passages throughout the Bible can get those shades of meaning on it because of, yeah. So that's a good resource I recommend there for helping with that. So when we're talking about our message here and where creation is beginning with the Ruach over the waters, the Ruach over the waters. We have the Ruach of Elohim, or the Spirit of God, is moving over the surface of the waters in Genesis 1-2. So thus we have that the beginning there with the Ruach. So in the beginning, we've got the Creator, we've got the Word, we've got the Spirit. They're all working together. And with the thing that's connected with the Spirit of God is also water. And then living water is a key part of that. And because one of the things that you'll see is where you'll see it flowing down into chapter 2 and chapter 3, where you get this phrase of creation, and a key aspect of creation is nefesh, which is soul or spirit, and chayim, which is life. So you get the compound phrase of nefesh chayim, or a living spirit or a living soul. And that is a key aspect where you see the first man, where God takes the Adama, and then he forms it into Adam, and then he breathes ruach, and then it becomes a nefesh chayim, or a living spirit, living soul. So those together bringing life. So thus, we see this theme is going to return, where God's Spirit and His presence are going to rule, and that disorder is transformed towards life. And you'll see this, we've actually gone over this somewhat recently when we were going through some passages in the book of Yeshayahu or Isaiah, especially like in 45, Isaiah 45. I mean, it's like almost the same language. In fact, in case it is the same language you see in Genesis 1, where the land, in this case, the land is said it was formless and void. And thus he's saying, I did not leave Israel in tovu vobohu, or formless and void, to be nothing. So basically the message coming through God, through the prophet is, hey, Israel is heading off into exile, but it is not just going to become a wasteland and nothing. No, he formed Israel to be something, to do something. Well, it has to get back to that original purpose. You have to remember your original purpose. And we all end up at that point. That's where they have talked for men about a midlife crisis, where you reach a point in your life and you're like, where am I going? What am I doing? Have I accomplished anything in life? Do I want to try going in some other direction? And you realize, oh, what is it that your whole life has been all about? And that's where having a grounding in something more than yourself is extremely helpful. You know, for believers, you've got the grounding in the Creator of heaven and earth, and then you've got the grounding in your family. So between the Creator and between your family grounds you as the guy facing a what is this all about sort of thing. Yeah, this is what it's all about. And you see that like at the book of Ecclesiastes, where he's going this way and that way and wondering about this and that, and all of it is chavel, or it's all meaningless and wind. Well, no, he realizes, no, the whole purpose of life is about following the instructions of God, keeping the commandments. And from that, it's not just an end in and of itself. It becomes, oh, that is where you really find life and not just pursue after death. So thus, when you move on here further, yes, Eden, life is flowing outward from God's dwelling. So Genesis 2 talks about that. When 2:10, there's a river flowed out from Eden to water the garden. And then in verse 2:9, the tree of life also is in the midst of the garden. So you've got these things, this river of life and the tree of life are both flowing there at the beginning. So yeah, Eden is not a like self-contained abundance. Water is flowing outward from it to then be a source to water all of the rest of the area around it. So that becomes a very important stream that's come through both Jewish and Christian interpretation throughout the centuries of why there's a lot of associations between Gan Eden, or the Garden of Eden, and the Mishkan, or the dwelling place of God, the tabernacle and temple, because those both are depicted throughout Scripture as being a source of life and a center for God's presence in the world to be a positive change and to bring positive change and light. So like in Genesis 3, one of the things we see in there, of course, that's talking about the so-called description of the fall, but it's talking about where you see the battle of the trees and the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, and those being together. But one of the things that you see in another parallel is that what happens when in Adam and Chava, or Adam and Eve, get thrown out because they decided to listen to the snake, listen to the adversary, and really question, hey, is God actually correct about all this and what he's saying? So when they decided to seek knowledge from somewhere else, they're said, okay, we don't need this to continue living on forever. So thus, there has to be a rescue plan, has to start initiating. So thus, at the end of it, when Adam and Eve are then barred from the garden, you see that the cherubim, are positioned right there at the gate to guard the way to the tree of life. And you see some parallels also, because one of the things you see in Ezekiel is that this gate is shut. This gate is shut until a very important thing happens, where you have then the opening of the gate, or boom. Yeah, for having the presence of the Lord coming, and the one who would be the gate opener is going to come. So thus, this is not just a matter of rule breaking. Humanity, what have we lost? We've lost this intimate, this personal one-to-one connection, just like you see later with Moshe speaking with the creator of heaven and earth face-to-face. We've lost that. We've lost that connection. We've lost the access to life where we can just go and get regenerated, however that happens, and then just continue to live on and on. Our life is finite, and we deal with all of the groaning of that on a daily basis, a lot. And we also have lost this kind of unhindered fellowship where we can just go anytime that we would seek and have an appointment. And thus you have the presence right there. Now we see, since we got these appointments coming up again, and we're celebrating one appointment here today, is where the Lord sets these appointments and saying, okay, yeah, in particular on these appointments, pay attention. Really pay attention, even so much so that he says, okay, on certain ones of these, stop everything you're doing. Stop everything you're doing, because these appointments are so necessary. I know at my work, we were just joking about this on Friday, talking about how many meetings that we have, which are all appointments on our calendar. I look at my calendar and it's got like almost every minute of the day has got some sort of meeting, one or the other. But the thing is, we all know which ones we can blow off and which ones we can't. So we're like, okay, which of these do we actually have to attend? And which of the other ones are like, okay, they're there, but yeah, okay. So those are the things that we then have to start looking at the calendar that God gives us and say, all right, which of these do we sort of consider to just, oh, we just blow it off and maybe not so important, but then just like with our meetings that we have in our everyday life, when we have a meeting, we go, oh, I got to get to this meeting. I've got to attend this meeting. Why? Well, because number one, there might be something on the line, you know, if it's a job-related thing or some other important thing where there's a really important reason why we have to be there. So we all will move heaven and earth, so to speak, to get to that appointment and make that appointment happen. Versus other ones, that's where we don't really see that there's much on the line. We can just, yeah, and we tend to just let them slide. And I know I sometimes have to watch out that I'll add too many things onto my calendar that are probably things that I shouldn't add onto my calendar. So that's always a thing that we have to watch for on a regular basis. So, yeah. Thus, One of the things that we have is that the Mishkan, again, comes from the Hebrew word of the verb shachan. Shachan means to dwell. And you, a rule of thumb, it doesn't mean in all cases, but a general rule of thumb in Hebrew is that if you've got, you got the mem or the m-like character in front of a Hebrew verb, it means it's like the place or the thing of. So for shachan is dwelling, Mishkan is dwelling place. And thus, the name there for the tabernacle of the Mishkan is an apt name for it, because that says, I will put my presence there. It says, build this for me, and then I will put my presence there. So yeah, it's definitely not on the fringe area. In Numbers 2, we see that the tribes are positioned all around it. And, you know, we see this particular map that we have that shows the location of all the tribes around it. And some, you see, the sages have come up with various traditions as to why they're located in particular areas like that. One that, you know, is very interesting is that since the messianic prophecies center around the tribe of Yehuda or Judah, thus, who's at the entrance? Yes, the tribe of Yehuda is at the entrance there on the east side. So the east side of it. So thus, when you look at the temple that Ezekiel is talking about, which gate is closed? The east gate. Because who's coming? Yes, you got the promise of the Messiah coming then through the eastern gate, through the tribe of Yehuda, the leader of the tribe of Yehuda, the ultimate one, but then is also the leader of all the brothers, will they then be coming through unto the eastern gate through there. But the sense is that there is the orderly assembly of all of the tribes around where the boss is, where the creator of heaven and earth, and that's where you center your life around. So, as we then are looking back, John's got a comment or a question.
Yes, I saw a video about the east gate being all cemented up.
They tried hard.
Yeah, they've cemented it up, and then it was also discovered that there's a fault line that runs from the Mount of Olives right to the east gate. Oh my God. Some Jews that were trying to put a hotel or something on Mount Olives had to do a geological survey, and they discovered a fault line that goes from Mount Olives straight to the East Gate, which is indicative of a lot of the prophecies where the Messiah of Judah will split the mountains and it'll go right the there, and it'll that cemented gate will fall, and as he walks in.
Well, somehow though, I don't think the creator of heaven and earth is going to need a fault line, but that is a good point when you see about splitting the earth, that's exactly where it goes through. Indeed. All right. So kind of moving on here further, looking under the hood further, we talked about this before, about the two key words that you see in Numbers talking about the census. One of those is Pakad, and it's variously translated as number. An interesting one meaning that you see throughout the Bible is for mustering, and it's a word that is somewhat archaic in English, but for mustering, or basically to get people assembled for a particular task. And often when we talk about it is for mustering forces for a military operation. So a muster can be voluntary or involuntary. And in the involuntary one, we have a different word for it. We call it a draft. And you draft the people, and they say, you must show up. So thus, we see that the preparation for this in Numbers 1-3, that's you talking about Moshe and Aharon shall number or pakad them by their families. So this census, or this numbering, mustering, appointing, it's asking, well, who is there? Where do they belong? and what household claims them, what tribe, and then what responsibility. And we'll see that as that goes on, especially it hinted at that at the beginning part of the end part of what we were looking at today in Numbers 2, where it talks about the tribe of Levi or Levi, that they are the ones that are going to be dealing with the emblems that are inside the Mishkan, the dwelling place, the tabernacle. And one of the things that we see in the experience, Bemidbar, or in the wilderness, this experience is really meant to take Israel from a bunch of individuals, or even a family, and maybe some might say a dysfunctional family that you see throughout Scripture, to take them, but in turn them into a cohesive unit that has its anchor being God's dwelling place, where there that is their source of strength and their sense of ordering. So, thus, you see that that is what is talked about often, and the goal of for basic training in the military or with any operation that needs to be at peak teamwork, where you have to really take a lot of the edges around people with their individualism and to say, look, you've got to work together so that you get to the point where someone else does not have to worry about where you are, because they know that you're each fitting into a role and that they can expect you to be there. Now, the kind of training I know about that is related to music. And if you're working in any particular musical group, after a while, if you've trained or you call practice together a lot, what happens over time? If you can start jamming, and a key aspect of jamming is that you trust the other people to be where you expect them to be. I've been in a number of jam sessions where people are not predictable. They're not predictable, and it ends up in a disaster because you cannot trust that they will be there. They will be on the beat, that they will be finishing certain sections where you expect them to be, etc. And then you don't have a really cohesive unit. And if you're working in a company and you've trained that each person has a role, and then you've got people who just decide to go out and try to do other people's roles, or they don't do their own role, then when you need them and you need things to really go into quick succession and to get a task done where people are taking parts of it and just going, if people aren't, you could say, pulling their weights or trying to then step into other and take other people's weight off of them without any sort of coordination, then what happens? Chaos can happen. I mean, in my line of work, there's not a terrible amount of teamwork that often happens, but sometimes there's things that we're working on story and it needs to be done quickly. So we sit down, we figure out, okay, you're going to talk to these people, you're going to talk to these people, you're going to get these documents, and you just do it. And we say, we got to be back together to put all these parts together in a half an hour. And so you're like, okay, you expect at the end of the half an hour that each person who's been going off to do their thing is going to come back and you'll have your pieces and then try to weave them all together. But that is what a team or a group of people do. Oh, yes, John's got a comment or a question over there.
Reminds me of being in actors in a play. They do all the rehearsal beforehand, and they get into this, hopefully, sort of a zone where they can play off of each other. And then when the performance day comes, they're in that harmonious, cohesive jam session where they trust each other, and it becomes a fun dynamic.
Yeah. And my limited experience with that is that if people don't know their lines, things will fall apart very, very quickly. Yes. All right. So moving on here further, one of the things that we get as this rolls on through Numbers is, this is not a bunch of anonymous people. That's, you have the congregation down to the family, to the father's household, the name, and then the individual. And you've got the connections by their families, by their father's households, and that repeated refrain that goes over and over and over again. So yeah, the person, one of the things we get of this is the person is not swallowed by the collective, nor detached from it, but realize that you're all parts of a whole, that you are all then connected to it. And when we see kind of earlier on in the book of Ezekiel into Ezekiel 37, where you got that vision of the two sticks in the Lord's hand and the Lord connects to them, one of those talk about what? One and their associates and the other and their associates. So basically, you've got people that are associating and joining to one or the other. And thus, they become part of a whole in the Lord's hand. The Lord is going to take two and bring them together in one. And at that time, when the prophet was writing, you had divided kingdom. You had Yehuda, and then you had Israel, or in the northern kingdom, and the southern kingdom of Yehuda, and they were separate. But it said, no, the Lord was going to take them and put them together in the Lord's hand. So that the Ephraim, Manasseh, was then going to be joined together and brought together in the Lord's hand. And those who joined to them, which is very similar to then what we see in chapter 47, when we start seeing at the end where it says, all of the land grants and the land is divided amongst the people. Who else is included in those land grants? Those foreigners who come in and they become a part of the whole. They become a part of this one mission together. And they then become a part of the inheritance. And the land and the inheritance goes then to those who have basically moved from who they were, and it says they are like the native born. So their land where they have come from is not their home anymore. Their home is the place where the Lord is planted. So thus they become inheritors within it. Yes, and talk about Ruth. It's one of the classic examples why we read the book of Ruth there around the time of Shavuot, because Shavuot is a great picture of the Lord bringing together the nations in for the great harvest. So yes, even though you've got these various tribes, you may have also separate missions. And we see that as you go throughout the rest of the Bible, and we'll see that in just a moment. So they had different banners, and Numbers chapter 2 talks about their banners and their identities, and talking about the 12 tribes. And it mentions there in Numbers 2:17, yeah, just as they camp, so they will set out. So yeah, they have different divisions, but they're going out as one whole. And that is the key point. Yeah, they're organized separately. They're going to march out in different orders, but they're all a part of one people, one collective, yet they are individuals. But yeah, that unity does not mean sameness, doesn't mean that you're all carbon copy one or the other. Each of the tribes had its own distinctness, but they are all a part of one whole. And you see how that plays out as the Bible rolls on near the end of the book of Numbers. We'll get to that when we get near the end in chapter 32. It's talking about, the obligations then for the various tribes when they get their different territories assigned to them throughout the land, yet they also have responsibilities to be a part in doing and carrying out what the Lord is bringing forward. They're having a separate territory not permitted. And it says there in Numbers 32, verse 6, shall your brothers go to war while you yourself sit here? And that was then, as we'll see, they came in to the land from the east. So modern day Jordan. So it came up through modern day Jordan and are coming in across the Jordan River from the east. And in the process of that, they captured territories on the east bank of the Jordan. And they started settling those areas. And so the directive was, hey, you've got your land now. Don't now think, okay, I'm fine. You guys have a good time over there on the west side of the Jordan. No, you're all a part of this together. So thus, you all will be a part of bringing this to a fruition. So yeah, being a lone wolf there in the family of God, we can just say, I've got mine. I've got my deliverance. So I've got my connection to the Father. So thus, what need do I have to participate in anything else? Versus a question that we should ask as we see the example of the people of God throughout time is, have my brothers, my sisters, have they reached their goals yet and where God is taking them? And if not, then are we just saying, oh, fine, we got ours, you have a good time, and maybe, hopefully, you get yours? Or do you rather then join in the effort together to go towards the goals where God is taking you? And we see throughout the book of Judges some examples of where those tribal distinctions have both a part in serving to get things done, and also you can start bringing in the rivalries and suspicions that maybe they aren't getting things done together. So you see that when Deborah and Barak, when they were trying to muster some of the tribes, some of them came with them, some didn't. And like it's recorded there in Judges 5:23, they did not come to the help of the Lord, because who was the ultimate one who was calling them up? The Lord was bringing the action. Adonai was saying, hey, we've got to come and finish this task. But some came and some didn't. And we see like at the end of Judges and chapter 21, verse 25, and this can be taken all kinds of different ways, but the simple explanation, the most straightforward one, when it says, every man do what was right in his own eyes, some have taken that to say, okay, well, everybody's got the Torah, so everybody is good. But functionally, what you see happen throughout the history of Israel as it rolls out further is that you started seeing things unravel, and you would have to have, as it talks about through Judges, the different one judge after another, and then eventually then you started moving into the kings, and the kings would have to come along. And then you'd have the kings would go on to one sort of dalliance and diversion and distraction after another. But over time, what did you start seeing people pointing toward? The king and what the king was doing versus what it was that the people of God should be going after. And thus you would have to have what? Prophets would have to come and kick the kings back into order. And sometimes the kings would listen, oftentimes they wouldn't. John, you've got your hand up there for a comment or a question.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture back then different tribes, you know, why they would separate, I guess. You know, maybe one tribe is not keeping the Torah perfectly and the other brothers are like, well, they're not fully our brothers, but they knew better back then who their tribe was, I guess, and what the other tribes were. I'm trying to think about bringing this to today, like how do we know what our brothers and tribes are and all that sort of thing. pick a denomination or what?
Yeah, I know that there's been quite a lot of people who have gone through various genealogies and tracked down various ways to see what tribe they may be descended from. And that was great if you had like the temple in place where you had a lot of the genealogical records were kept. Pretty much today, other than Levi, that lineage has been kept largely intact. But beyond Levi, good luck. A lot of people have tried to trace to one tribe or another, but yeah, it's really hard pressed beyond the tribe of Levi to see where that goes. So thus you're saying, well, if you're looking at the prophecy that you see in Ezekiel, then what does that leave then for the rest of us? Well, that gets back to what we were just talking about earlier with the fact that you have these foreigners who have come in and that they have basically given up their allegiance to their old land, their old gods, and have now made Israel and the God of Israel their home, their center. What do you see then the Lord doing? Is apportioning them along with the other tribes that are there. So thus, one of the things that we can see is, all right, we put our whole focus upon the kingdom of God and let God figure out the genealogy whenever that happens. Because at this point, trying to trace things can be a fraught sort of activity. Yes, but that is a great question, because that comes up a lot and people are wondering, well, what tribe am I? Am I Judah, or maybe I've got the so-called attributes of one or the other? Larry has got a comment or a question over here. Salts or light scattered all over. Yes. Larry has got a comment or a question over there. Yeah.
It seems to me that Cohens are pretty tight. Is that true?
Yeah, Cohens. Well, that's from Levi. So the tribe of Levi, so the priests. Yeah. And that's particularly why, because even after the temple was destroyed, the tradition came in is that the tribe of Levi, and especially the Kohanim or the Cohens, would be important because they would continue on as does today with the special blessings that come through, especially the blessing of the tribe of Aaron, which historically and traditionally done by the Kohanim, those who are descended from them. So Anne has got a comment or a question over there.
Wasn't it also through the Kohenites, the rebellion came with the two leaders there, but in the end it didn't kill off all of those. Are you understanding where I'm coming from with?
Oh yes, yeah. Talking about around here, you've got the family of the Kohat. Yes, and then you've got rebellions that then came up off of that because they had assignments, as we've seen throughout the Bible, to do certain things in certain order and that sort of thing. But they, as you can see, they weren't a part of the family of Aaron, so they weren't involved in the priesthoods happening inside. They basically were the schlepsters, and it was a very important task that nobody else outside of their family could do, but it wasn't the task of the Kohanim or the priesthood. So they were then questioning, well, who made you in charge? Moshe and Aharon? Yeah, Moses and Aaron? Who put you in charge? And then sadly, heaven had to remind them who put them in charge. Yeah, they found out real quickly. Yes, a very difficult way. But yes, as you were noting, that there were noted to be descendants later on from them. There were descendants that later on from them. So thus, you had to figure that, when it was talking about who was taken out, it was the ones that, you know, by heaven's wisdom would be the rabble-rouser families that were the ones were the source of the whole rebellion. And it's a very difficult topic because you think of there was the whole families that went down with them. And that gets into a lot of the topics that go in today about, well, what were happening about all the families of the land of Canaan, the land of Canaan, where you saw that the Lord said, go in and just clean everybody out. So thus the creator of heaven and earth, the one who gives life and the one who takes it, then was saying, okay, trust me with this instruction. Oh, so the question here is that why would the Lord make the command of humans to go in and take out people if he had done that before, like with the flood? The flood was a key thing of just wiping everything out, animals, everything that was outside of the ark, including humans on that. Now, it does not say specifically, I want you to take them out, specifically you humans, to do this because da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't ever say why it is that humans are involved with that. However, maybe it's a topic that we're getting at here today with the tabernacle. I mean, we could have this tabernacle drop down, you know, like Star Trek style and materialize right there in front of us. And like, okay, this place is so holy, I don't want any of you to touch it. I don't want any of you to be involved with it whatsoever. Yet, what do you see the instructions? Gather everything together. I want contributions for it. The Terumah. I want your contributions for this. And then you start seeing where the heart of the people was at with their contributions. Okay, their heart was truly into it because they kept bringing and bringing and bringing, especially where you see scripture places this Terumah was right after the golden calf and then the redemption after the golden calf. So thus, you get a picture in a sense that this was an outpouring of gratefulness for the mercy that had been given to them, that they had been spared, so they would give their contributions to it. And then heaven gives the blueprint for it, the pattern after which it was to be built. So then the instructions came, okay, here is all the instructions, now you do it. You actually put this together. And you build it all. And then after it's all built, then, okay, everybody get out. Even Moshe, get out. And here comes the presence of God moving into it. And then after that, then you started seeing this was going to be a very selective entry. Because all of the work, the workers who were in there working on the Holy of Holies, they're the ones who built the Aron, the Ark of the Covenant, the ones who built that could never touch it ever again. The ones who were working all the metal, who had done all the hammering of the gold all over the whole thing, who had done the hammered work of the cherubim on the lid and everything, they could never touch it ever. They couldn't even look at it ever again. So it had to be covered. So they had to contribute it, and then they had to get out and never touch it or see it again. So thus, these are works that, you know, heaven could have just dropped the thing right in there and just made it materialize. Yet, this was said, you build it, and I will occupy it. Yes, you build it, and I will occupy it. So back to the question you have is, well, why could heaven have just taken care of the cleaning out of the land, the judgments upon the people of the land, versus having people to actually do it? Well, it is a terrible, gruesome task. It's a terrible, gruesome task. I mean, we think that, oh, you know, just back in the ancient world, it was people didn't think much of it. Well, we see it recorded in the Bible that it got to a particular point where they weren't wanting to do it anymore. You see it, the example of Agag, and the instruction was, yeah, take him out too. And they hedged on that until finally the prophet had to do it because the army would not do it. So thus, you see the picture that, it is a terrible task. Terrible task involved. But realize what it is that's actually being carried out, and be very careful then with your approach in doing it. Yeah, so that it is an extremely difficult question, but yeah, a great one that we need to revisit on a regular basis. All right, so we talked about that, counting. So moving on further, one of the things about tribal fragmentation, and this goes into a little bit further about, moving on a little bit. I'll just go back a little bit on that. Sorry, just a moment. That one of the things that you also see in the history of Israel is when they decided to, when they were coming in and they, when the tribes were coming in after they were conquering, or before they were conquering the land, and they planted the tribes there on the half tribe of Manasseh, half was on the eastern side, half on the western side. Thus, they said, oh, we are going to build what? Over on the eastern side. An altar. They built an altar over there, and the rest of the tribes heard about it and go, wait a minute. You know, there is one altar there, and you know, we went through a lot of instructions and we built it and it's there. So what is this thing doing over here on the east bank of the Jordan? And they were getting ready to go all to war until they got a delegation together from the tribes plus the high priest, and they went over and were asking, what is this? Why'd you build this? And the accusation was, hey, are you now just trying to go your own way and have your own connection to God? Because he said, hey, centralize it here in one place. Don't be doing it on every high place like a lot of the pagan nations do. And the answer that came back was, oh no, we wouldn't think of doing such a thing. This is to remind us we belong also to what is going on the eastern, on the west of the Jordan. So all that's going on the east bank of the Jordan, all the tribes over there, is also a part of what's going on the west side. We're all a part of the same family. So this altar here is not a replacement for, it is a memorial to what the real one is, and remind us, hey, yeah, there is an actual one there. And so that message then was received. Okay, we understand now what your heart is. You're not trying to divide yourself off and make your own substitute thing over here. Rather, no, it's to remind you of where it is you came from. Contrasting north and south. Well, that then came much, much later. And so, yeah, they ended up with not only just one separate altar, but two. And not just one golden calf, but two of them. So got to make sure that you get the whole area in easy access to the golden calf. Is that you just definitely need really easy access to an idol. What is definitely not an idol talk is over in Luke chapter 15. And one of the topics we see here is that this is really one continual parable. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But yeah, it is not talking about a wandering sheep at the beginning of it, but rather you're having an argument about who should be received. And that's really how the preface of this whole passage is, about this man receives sinners and eats with them. So that is the context of where the parable is then going to reach. And so thus the answer comes with the parable of one lost sheep, one lost coin, one lost son. And then finally, as a part of that that prodigal son parable, you have the one resentful son who does not enter the celebration. And that, you could say, is a bit of the punchline to all of the unified but multifaceted parable, which is in Luke 15. So the question then that comes from that punchline is, well, does our definition of holiness agree with the Father's desire to restore? So in looking at this multifaceted parable, Luke 15:3 introduces this as this parable. And so you see that these proportions are growing over time. That's, it's 1 out of 100 sheep, then it becomes 1 out of 10 coins, and then it becomes 1 out of 2 sons. And when you look at that prodigal son parable, you're looking at both of these sons are sort of alienated to a certain degree. You have one that leaves geographically, but one who is there geographically, but is relationally, he has kept himself sort of outside to a certain degree. And we'll explore that a little more as we go on. But yeah, it's not just one particular category, but it is talking about lostness to us to a varying degrees of this. So in the first parable of the sheep, you don't just say, hey, 99%, that's a great retention rate. I mean, there's a lot of businesses and operations that would be ecstatic if you only have, if you have 99% retention rate. I tell you, a lot of wineries I talk to, if their wine club had 99% retention rate, they would be vacationing like all the time. Because you know what the actual retention rate in a wine club is? It is like 60%. So 60. So 40% of the time, there people are going in, they're going out. They're going in, they're going out. Going in, going out. So you have like 40% of your revenue is turning over all the time. And I could say, well, hey, 60% of guaranteed, that's great. But you see, talking about the kingdom of God, 60% is not what heaven is satisfied with. And 99% is not what heaven is satisfied with. But rather, you see in Luke 15:4, he goes after the one which is lost until he finds it. Something that's why we have this verse in every single service that we do, is because this parable in particular is a very important way for us to center ourselves in what our purpose here is. We're not lone wolves out here that kind of happen to bounce around against each other once a week or even more, depending on the season. No, this is all a part of an entire effort. The whole kingdom of God is oriented towards this. Go after the one which is lost until he finds it. So a very similar thing that you see back in Numbers, that yeah, once people are counted, your absence becomes noticeable. It's when you have various organizations. If you have an organization and a board, you have a roll call, and you even probably have in your bylaws about certain requirements for quorum and such. Now, in human terms, okay, we can get by with a certain number of people missing. But for heaven's goal is really to have everybody present. Now, the word tells us again and again and again, that is not going to be how it totally ends up. But that is heaven's goal, is that all would be saved. All won't be saved, but heaven's goal is for all to be saved. So if that's heaven's goal, well then, shouldn't that be ours? If that was our master's goal, shouldn't that be ours? That we should be looking to have all that are called then be selected and to answer the call. So you see the shepherd's response is, hey, notice there's someone missing, to pursue the person find the person, carry the person home, then you have the return, and then the celebration. So thus, you see that the end goal is to bring that lost sheep home. And then you see the joint celebration, that everybody is celebrating the return. So the parallel passage to this is in Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew. This parable is told in the midst of Matthew 18. And we see in Matthew 18 that this context is talking about you having the little ones. The little ones are stumble. Or it says there in Matthew 18:14, it is not the will of the Father that one of these little ones perish. And you have that talked about. This is a horrific situation that you are talking about the innocent ones in the family of God. And thus, there are forces that are coming in, malactors coming in, and are thus then leading off and corrupting the most innocent little ones of the congregation. And then you also have, as it goes on, the conflict resolution. And we as a congregation have gone through this conflict resolution system that the master has put in place. We've used this before. And one of the goals that you see in Matthew 18:15 says, if he listens to you, you have won your brother. So basically the system is, if you've got someone who is sinned against you, you go try to work it out between you. If that doesn't work, then you bring someone along, you know, not to witness you punching him in the face, but rather, no, to then come by and try to talk together. And if that doesn't work, then you are bringing it to the congregation. And then with that, if it doesn't work with that, then you are to what? It says to treat the person as one of these types of classes of people that, hey, you need to reach. You need to reach out to. Because those classes of people, the tax collectors, etc., were also people that Yeshua himself personally reached out to. The mission field. Yes, that's another good way to put that. But yeah, not the objective to win the argument, but rather it is to win a brother or a sister back into the family. That being the point. And in the lost coin parable, the coin, it's a very interesting thing. A lot of people have reflected on this over the centuries and about why is it you're talking about a sheep, talking to various people, shepherds, farmers, etc., as to the brain power of sheep, but it's not considered to be terribly high and very, a lot of herd mentality that goes on with sheep. Yet the idea, okay, they've got some sort of brain going on. Well, the coin doesn't have a brain. It is either lost or it isn't. It's either found or it isn't. It's not like it's deciding to be one place or another. But you see the description there of the woman lighting the lamp, sweeping, searching, and she searches carefully until she finds it. And thus, we can say searching diligently, just like with the lost sheep, that we can't take the attitude of, well, they chose to leave. Now, we can have lots of conversations, and it may be one that we'll just have to stick a bookmark in and revisit it at some point in time in our conversations with people that have, and our family members who have decided to go away from the family of God. But you can't just treat it, oh, well, I guess they'll be them, and off they go. But if heaven doesn't treat the situation as something where you just have acceptable losses, then we will just keep appealing on like behalf of the kingdom of heaven until the time is where there is no time no longer. for the appeal to go forward. So yeah, we have some people that through various reasons of neglect, or they're just wrapped up in grief, or there's some sort of conflict, or they were mistreated or abused, or there's like something has happened within their family and they just can't travel anymore, or they can't get to meeting services or whatever, or failures of leadership, etc. That's, there's a lot of reasons why people have gone this way or that way. But in a type of a community like the one talked about in Numbers and you see throughout the Bible, where each person is a part of a whole, we should then orient ourselves to that direction that we notice when people are gone, when our family members drift off. We notice, and we are then praying for and moving toward that kind of diligence to see, oh, what has happened? What's going on? How can we help? Are we the problem? What is the issue? So yes, with the younger son, and various people over the centuries have gone off on this a lot as to what his reason was for leaving, et cetera, if he was basically wanting to cash in on his inheritance early, considering his father dead. Oh yeah, so there's all kinds of theories that have gone over time. But basically, the end result was he just thought the grass was greener on the other side, so to speak. Yes, John, you got a comment or a question there?
Yeah, I guess they have to be, like you said before, counted in first, right? I'm wondering about the seeming contradiction about, you know, only those that God draws are the ones that are in, and yet he wants to save everybody. So...
yeah, was it many are called, but few are chosen. Yeah. So the call goes out to all the earth.
So we're talking about saving people who are already in and then are like drifting away, as opposed to people who never were in, but then...
yeah, and that then goes into the big, huge conversation that's like centuries in the making about predestination, etc. Is someone predestined to be out, predestined to be in?
Common pots and uncommon pots, yes. Clay pots.
Yeah. Exactly. So basically, rather than trying to say, well, he was predestined to be lost, we should just say, look, we look towards heaven's goal of that 100% in. It may not end up that way, but we always have the goal of being 100% in the kingdom. It may not end up that way, but that is what the goal is, that not one would be lost. And we leave it up to heaven to decide what actually happened, because it may be that he just goes off to somebody else, and then that somebody else is the instrument that becomes the part of what God uses to bring the person back. But we should not be the reason they just kiss somebody off and just, okay, they're lost, and just let them go. So that is always a huge rallying call for us. So with that, we'll kind of bring things in for a landing here with really kind of the now what. You know, if we're tempted to kind of have this lone wolf faith of where we can just think we can just follow after Adonai, it's our own thing, it's our own journey, and we can do it all ourselves and not really care about what the whole family of God is doing or being a part of it with other people around us. Yeah, that's something quite different from the kingdom of God. And if we were to take a census among us, yeah, well, who's missing? And we all know about the people who are missing. We pray about them on a regular basis. We reach out to them on a regular basis. But yeah, to just take a regular census around us of who is missing. And are we just assuming it's somebody else's responsibility if we notice that people are missing? And it may be that sometimes our responsibility is just to let other people know, you know, let the congregation leadership know about, hey, some people are missing. Are we doing anything about that? Or if we reach out to them or finding out if perhaps there is some sort of need that leadership is not aware of, that's some concern or something. And always a good assessment as to whether we are the, in the prodigal son, if we're the younger or the older brother. Yes. Whether, which side of that parable are we actually on? And, you know, really, is it something that we've separated ourselves from a congregation because of some issues or what it is? To really take a self-assessment on it as to if we've become separated from congregations or people because of this or that or the other. Now, one of the things that we kind of didn't have time to get to today, but we go over this at time of unleavened bread a lot because it's mentioned there in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. There was talking about the situation there in Corinth where you had this very deplorable situation that was going on there morally, but they were tolerating the situation and they were proud about how they were tolerating the situation. And the instructions that Paul had was, no, you've got to kick this person out and let them be out there. And it's like sifted by the adversary for the sake of him. And then when you get over to 2 Corinthians, the follow-up letter, there's been a lot of debate because the person isn't mentioned by name or even more specifics that are the same as the situation in 1 Corinthians 5. But you get a sense that there is this person that's talked about in 2 Corinthians that has come back and been reconciled into the congregation, and that there has been a sorrowful and very heartwarming reconciliation that has happened. And thus, that promise that you see in Matthew 18 of winning over your brother in the sense of bringing the person back, and they realized in what happened with being told to leave, that was a whole part of the coming back and being welcomed back. And like with the prodigal son, having a celebration when the person does return, that is something that is truly what heaven is looking for. So yes, what happens downstream of me? And we talk about this a lot when we get through the passages on the Lashon Hara, or the evil tongue. That's in a similar way, what happens downstream of me with the Spirit of God as well. Since we see in that picture of Ezekiel 47, this stream flowing out from the altar, it goes, very interesting imagery of it going underneath the threshold of, basically under the gate, the eastern gate, kind of going around toward the south end and going south down from the mountain and then going into the arid areas and even turning the Dead Sea into something that is fresh water. Turning the Dead Sea into fresh water. And you've got a huge amount of water. You saw that measuring part, how they kept measuring. Basically, it works out to about a third of a mile, a third of a mile, a third of a mile. And it keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Well, if you people who would be familiar with the geography of the area, if you were hearing this from the prophet and going, okay, you're on Zion, you're on Zion, Jerusalem, every direction is what? Downhill from there. And you start measuring out third of a mile, third of a mile, third of a mile, and it's up, getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. That is a tremendous amount of water that is filling up the areas around there. So you see that the Spirit of God is like filling everything to a huge degree and turning all of the places that are just, you can't drink it into places that are fresh water. And then you have these trees that are growing along either side of this river, and the leaves then are becoming for the healing of the nations. And there's been various interpretations throughout centuries on what the trees mean, and that what are those trees. And you get a picture of the tree of life, because the tree of life, the healing is in its leaves. You also get imagery, some possibilities people have brought forward is that they could be trees being also people, that they being sucking up the Spirit of God within them, and they are refreshed into that, and then they also become healing in the nations, that possibility being out there. But if you get this picture of we as temples of God, that's, you see the apostles bringing forward that we are also temples of God. Well, is the living water of the Spirit of God flowing out from us into the world around us to also take those areas that are completely undrinkable and to turn them into fresh water? So are we like a reservoir, or are we like a river? Are we like an area that's stagnant, that has become just completely grown over and just foul? Or are we living water because we have the Spirit of God that is flowing through us? So yeah, in closing, yeah, Adonai is gathering us around his presence, not merely so that we can be safe nearer the living water that's being poured out, but so that together, by his Ruach, by his Spirit, we become channels through which his coming kingdom begins touching the world's dead places right now. So, amen indeed. Yeah, may the Lord truly bring this to pass. Are there any last thoughts before we close out here today? John?
Yeah, a couple. The word come, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think in the Hebrew also can mean go, which makes me think of what you just said there at the end of you come, you get filled up maybe at the reservoir, and then you turn around and you go at the same time. But the other thing was about the prodigal son story. I've heard the two brothers being compared to the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Ephraim, the one that went away and never came back.
Oh, talking about the lost, the prodigal son?
Yeah, and the son at home being Judah, who kept all the commands and stuff, and that the father is like a God figure.
Well, I mean, you could bring it that, but remember that daddy, so to speak, brought out a big belt for Judah as well. And that was Nebuchadnezzar was the belt that was chosen for Yehuda.
Yeah, both sons are not really good sons.
Yeah, so that's it was basically a note that if you were reading between the lines, you would see that the son that stayed were basically the leadership of the time period, the same kind of category that the leadership that the Ezekiel and the other prophets were speaking to. And the lost son were all of the people that the leadership of the time period had considered to be deplorables and the unwashed and the unlearned, and that they had basically cast them off, whether they be the tax collectors, yeah, the pigs, because they've gone off and basically become living like pagans, whether they were over in the Decapolis actually eating pigs, or whether they had just considered them to be like pigs because they were not following one sect or another's definition of what being, you know, kadosh or holy was all about. Yeah, but that was a good observation there. Any other thoughts? Yes, Rose, go ahead.
I've just heard in times past of comparing those two sons as the church and Israel. I've heard ministers speak like that the son that was angry is the church, and the son that came back is the whole house of Judah. Mm.
Okay, well, I suppose that might be one way to put that. Yeah. All right. Tammy, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so, to kind of summarize this a little bit, if you think about it, we started out here with a census, right? We're just counting numbers and everything, and you just kind of wonder, what's the point of the counting? But, so when Moses counted every man 20 years and older, tribe by tribe, name by name, and then later on, they kind of group up in banners, right? Judah's in the east, Reuben in the south, and so on and so forth. And it does seem kind of tedious when you go through this, the rosters, the meetings, not everything, the totals, the marching orders. But the numbers, for the numbers to matter, it kind of shows us that, no one in Israel is anonymous and no one stands where he pleases. So you have God put everything in order, and that every person had a positive relationship with God's dwelling place. And that it was God's presence that gave that entire camp its shape, its order, and its purpose. But then later on, with Ezekiel, when he comes along, with the Babylonian exile, the Jews wondered whether that geometry, whether that special relationship still meant anything. Because at that point, there was no temple anymore. Most of the tribes, the quote lost tribes, right? They'd been scattered. And so God gives Ezekiel this vision that with the water flowing from the temple becoming a river, that it's to heal the Jewish people, so to speak. So Ezekiel seeing these 12 tribes being restored to their inheritance, their allotments and everything. But like you pointed out earlier, it's not just the 12 tribes that get an allotment. It's also the aliens or the sojourners also get an allotment. So it's expanding. And then that these aliens are to be treated as native born, receiving an inheritance alongside the tribal members. So that old geography that we see in the Book of Numbers is not rewritten, but it's expanded.
Yes.
And so the boundaries now stretch out to embrace these aliens, these strangers, so to speak, because the land ultimately belongs to God. And I think that's what people may be forgetting when they read these stories or whatever. Oh, the land belongs to the Jewish people. No, ultimately the land belongs to God. And he chose who lived where, because you see that even later on, when Joshua and everybody went in, the tribes, how they got sorted out in the land itself, not just around the tabernacle, but later on in the land, they get sorted out too. So then when you get to Luke 15, you see how God is actually pursuing the lost, not just we might get the idea, these aliens, they just stumble in and just by dumb luck, they become a part of the nation of Israel or whatever. And that's not what's going on. God actually seeks these people out actively. And so out of that 100 sheep, the 99 are safe, but there's one missing. And so the shepherd leaves to seek that one that's lost. And given the idea that heaven keeps count, where the Bible talks about every hair on our head is counted, God keeps count of everything. So if you think about it as a trajectory, so Numbers establishes that God knows his people individually, arranges them with the common life around his purpose and his presence. And Ezekiel insists that this ordering survives the catastrophe of exile and, ethnic cleansing and everything else. And he deliberately widens the net, though, also to include outsiders. And then Luke is the one that kind of reveals the heart behind both. The God who counts carefully precisely because he cherishes them personally, and who will not let a mathematical majority define the faithfulness when even one is outside the fold. So the scribes of Israel complained that Jesus welcomed the wrong people. Ezekiel had already promised that the alien would inherit, and then Numbers already insists that everyone and every head was named. So this community that's supposed to be around God's presence is not a closed formation, but a seeking, searching one. That the camp banners, when you think about your image of Numbers, or these banners, right? The Judah had a banner, these different colored banners and so on. they're not about keeping people in their place so much as that they are to orient the community towards the tabernacle, orient them towards God, orient them towards his purpose, towards his center. And that to be counted by God in the end is not merely to be tallied. So it's not just about counting numbers. You know, accountants, you love to count numbers, you love to count the money. So it's not just about counting the numbers, but it's that God wants, that we want to know that God knows who is there and that he wants everyone there. And when everyone is there, God has a big old party. He's going to have the biggest party. And we want to be at that party, but we don't want to exclude people from the party. We want to include people in that party.
Oh, that's wonderful. And that's a great sum up of what we have with the upcoming fall feasts and what we are going to be looking forward to with Sukkot and what we celebrate there with Shemini Atzeret, or the eighth day, with the great entering in of this era of God calling in and bringing in the nations.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.